Fresh Air Production.
So, Nihal, here we are.
Why don't you go first?
All right. Well, I want to go first anyway, because I'm very proud of my friend and co-presenter, Nihal Arthur-Naicker, who is an award-winning TV and radio journalist, BBC presenter, ex-hip-hop bad boy, he won't like me for saying that, and who is said by Ricky Gervais no less, and I quote, to be a national treasure. Which now worries me because most of our national treasure has been looted.
You'll have to spring me out of the British Museum, Dexter.
Yeah, so I can do this. You'll have to pay for it.
Reparations, Dexter, reparations. Now, Dexter QC is one of Britain's most eminent human rights barristers. When I first met Dexter, I interviewed him on my radio show, and immediately, instantaneously, we struck up a rapport, mostly because I was utterly in awe of the size of his brain, and also as well the passion that he has for changing the world. And not changing the world simply by writing a banner and marching up and down the street, but by looking at the legal system and working within it to help change the world. I mean, this is a man who's taken on cases involving freedom of speech, deaths in state custody, genocide, murder, and FGM. He really is utterly inspiring. We share so much when it comes to our values, when it comes to the things that really annoy us about the world that we live in. The difference being is I just talk about it on the radio. You go out to various different parts of the world and do something about it. And that's why I wanted to work with you, because actually what you do is, as I've already said, utterly awe-inspiring and incredibly difficult.
Well, look, the title of our podcast, The 100 Types of Human, is a kind of supersizing of the book that I wrote, The 10 Types of Human, because, you know, it's based upon my legal work on four continents, but also my interest and my research into this interface, this interesting interface between human rights and human psychology. So, look, how is it going to work, do you think?
I know exactly how it's going to work.
You and I,
we get together whenever we can to talk to some remarkable people. And it's that simple.
Yeah, and you know what? I mean, they are really some of the most incredible people on the planet.
Yeah, it's already been an amazing experience, I think, for both of us. And some of our guests have suffered terrible injustice or unimaginable trauma.
But what struck me is how they've turned their pain and suffering into this absolute determination to create social change.
And we want you, who've hopefully subscribed to this podcast, to hear what they have to say.
Today, we're starting with an amazing story of Marcia Rigg. One of the legal areas I've been deeply involved in for 30 years has been the fight for the rights of grieving families who've had their loved ones killed in state custody. And it's been amongst the most difficult work I do. And Marcia's story and the story of her brother Sean is deeply, deeply shocking.
Now, this conversation was recorded a couple of weeks ago, very soon after the killing of George Floyd, and the, well, reigniting of the Black Lives Matter movement across the globe.
And, you know, we should point out, you know, it wasn't the first podcast we recorded, but we felt the issues are just so important and relevant right now that we wanted to share it with all of you immediately.
Because, of course, you have an intimate knowledge of the legal system, but also cases such as this, as your book, of course, attests to most eloquently at the very beginning of it.
In 2007, perhaps we can talk about it a little bit later, I represented Gareth Myatt, who was a BME child who was killed in a prison. And one of the things that happens when you do this kind of work is that the faces of the people who you've represented, their relatives who hold their pictures in court and outside court, they don't leave you. And there's this strange sense that they were looking at me and asking me, saying, well, what are you doing now? This is a historic moment. What are you doing now? And, you know, the pushback against the reaction to Black Lives Matter in this country has been twofold, really, as I see it. Firstly, that it's not as bad here as in the United States. And secondly, it doesn't really happen here at all. And on that first point, I think it's really dangerous for us to play oppression top trumps and say, oh, well, it's worse in this jurisdiction than that jurisdiction, whereas we really need to focus on what's happening on our doorstep. And on that second point about it not really happening here, I know that it does happen because I've had to deal with these cases for 30 years. And in 2007, at the end of the inquest, when the jury reached a devastatingly critical verdict on how that child of mixed descent was treated and killed, Gareth's mum said to me, Dexter, you know it's going to happen again. You know it's going to happen again. What are we going to do about it? And that was 2007. And what I did, and I knew intellectually that it would. And it did, and it happened again in 2008. Didn't it, Marcia?
Yes, it did. My beautiful brother, Sean Rigg, who was handsome, very talented, a dancer in his teenage life, and wrote his own music, and wrote about his life. You know, a loving person who, you know, was no trouble to anybody. You know, he just sadly suffered from schizophrenia, and sometimes he wouldn't take his medication and he would become actively psychotic.
Which is very common with people who suffer from schizophrenia, isn't it?
Yes, because one of the effects that they have is that when they are feeling well, when they're on their medication, they tend not to take their medication because it does have side effects.
So Marcia, in 2008... in Brixton, in South London, can you tell us, if you can, I know it's going to be difficult, but if you can, what happened to your brother?
On August the 21st, 2008, my brother was actively psychotic because he was overdue his medication by 2 months. After a period of 3 hours, he left the building and went onto the high road in Brixton, naked from the waist up, just carrying his passport. He left his keys and his mobile phone, extremely unwell because he was in and out of traffic, and members of the public could see this, and they also called the police. When the police arrived, he was apprehended by 4 police officers from Brixton Police Station, pinned down to the ground in grass for a period of at least 7 minutes, handcuffed to the rear, searched because a witness had taken photographs which became very important evidence in Sean's case, and he was in a very similar position to how George Floyd was. And one of the officers was in his neck area, where the medical evidence shows that there was excessive force used there because there was deep bruising found in the medical evidence. He was then put in the back of a police vehicle where the officers claimed that he was upside down in the footwell area of the caged van. Inside the van, there is a cage, so he was locked in there. A very small area where they said that he was on his back, upside down, with his feet in the air, spinning 360 degrees in a very confined, restricted place, and you would, you know, he would have been handcuffed, so he was still being restrained and would have had difficulty to breathe as he did while he was being restrained in that prone position for 7 minutes. He was driven at speed to Brixton Police Station, and all the officers claim that they didn't recognise that he had a mental health. He was psychotic and didn't marry up the emergency 999 calls. And he was arrested for theft of his own cancelled passport because the officers claimed that the passport didn't look like his. He was driven at speed to the station, where he was kept in the yard in the vehicle for a period of 11 minutes. One of the officers claimed that he conducted a risk assessment and that he went to the van and he saw Sean and he looked at him directly in the eyes and he was sitting up and that he was fine. But we later proved that he did nothing of the sort. He was removed from the van in a collapsed state, heavily assisted by two officers. And within a few steps, he was caught on CCTV where Sean is collapsed to the floor at the feet of 5 to 6 police officers who claimed that he was faking it, that he was mute because he didn't speak at any point, and that he was asleep. And it can be seen on camera that Sean is extremely unwell. He was stood up by police officers, where a jury at the inquest found that he would have been fully unconscious at that stage. And the doctor was not sent to Sean until 8:13. He was arrested at 7:40 and arrived at Brixton Police Station at 7:53, kept in the van for 11 minutes, and then removed from the van at 8:03. By 8:13, my brother was collapsed, and he was literally a dying man, and he did die. And all of the officers claim that they didn't recognise that he was unwell. For 11 years, the family fought a very challenging legal process with the IPCC, now the IOPC, and the Crown Prosecution Service, because the IPCC found that the officers did absolutely nothing wrong whatsoever to Sean. But the evidence was compelling and in stark contrast. None of the officers were made accountable in my brother's death. We did have the first perjury trial, where the sergeant who had claimed that he visited Sean in the back of the van, the CCTV proved that he did nothing of the sort. He was acquitted. And also some of the officers attempted to retire. PC Andrew Burks, now the Reverend Andrew Burks, he attempted to retire, and for the first time after various judicial reviews, that was U-turned and he was subsequently suspended. Years later, the Crown Prosecution Service found that there was insufficient evidence to prosecute any of the officers for any wrongdoing whatsoever. And last year, in January 2019, we had a gross misconduct hearing. We had to challenge that be a public hearing, because the officers had claimed that because after 10 years they couldn't remember the circumstances of my brother's death, even though it was captured on CCTV. On the 1st of March 2019, it was found that the officers did absolutely nothing wrong. And what was alarming, or is alarming, is the fact that somebody can be restrained in the prone position, face down, where they cannot breathe, for a period of 7 minutes. And the Metropolitan Police found that that was not excessive. So that means that somebody can be restrained in that position for 7 minutes and it is not excessive and it is not inappropriate, even to the point of death. How can that be? How can that be? And we have no more legal challenges.
Marcia, there are two questions I would like to ask you. Firstly, did you watch the video of what happened to George Floyd? And secondly, if you did, what were your first emotional reactions to watching that video?
Yes, I did watch that video and I witnessed the murder of George Floyd with my very own eyes, as did the rest of the world. And I was mad as hell because that's how my brother died. I was absolutely furious. It's emotionally upsetting and traumatic for any family to witness the death of their loved one. And the officers in my case claimed that Sean never spoke once, but I sincerely believe that he must have uttered the words, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe." And nobody cared. And what it does is that the pain is perpetuated because there are so many Sean Reeves, there are so many George Floyds, and this has been happening for decades. It's nothing new at all, nothing new. It's been happening in the United Kingdom for decades, as I say. And we have no closure. Families have no closure, and the pain is just forever and forever and forever. How can that be? It's now time for there to be proper accountability. Officers should not be allowed to restrain somebody in that position, because you see, there's a public eye. So this is not a coincidence. This is something that happens globally, and it cannot be right that an officer can restrain somebody in that position to the point of death and not be made accountable. And so my pain is still perpetuated because of it.
Marcia, what are your coping mechanisms? This fight has taken over a decade of your life, and I marvel at your strength, but I also worry for how you carry such a burden around with you.
This is a spiritual journey for me, and I believe that I was put on this earth to do this job. The fact that there is no justice, and to know that my brother died in this way, because my family had to become investigators ourselves. I mean, I can hear on the CCTV that the officers are saying that he's dying and he's dead. But the Crown Prosecution Service has said, yeah, we can hear it, but we do not know in what context it is being said. Well, there's only one dead man in the police station and they're looking at him. You know, one of the officers said, you can't get a dead man standing. And that is what keeps me going. The fact that I was given a decomposed body for burial has kept me going. The fact that I've met so many other families that have suffered the same fate has kept me going, because we can never give up, ever. Otherwise, they will have won. And so you have to keep going. And the strength and the support of the media, to keep a mass media campaign, has always been my weapon. And for somehow, I just keep going.
But Marcia, we've met on other cases, haven't we? And one of the things that you have done, and you have done amazingly, is that you have turned that grief and that pain and that anger into a weapon itself, but it's a positive weapon, a sword, which you've used to help other grieving families who I've represented to try to get to the truth. And in all the cases, I've been doing these cases for 30 years. And in every single case, the thing the families tell me, as I represent their dead ones, their beloved, the beloved members, their brothers and their sons, and occasionally their daughters, what they tell me is that part of the strength that they have comes from the fact they don't want anybody else to go through what they have gone through. So could you just, I'm really interested, because a lot of the pushback that there has been about Black Lives Matter is that it can't happen here and it doesn't happen here. What would you say to people who peddle that view, whether it's on Twitter or in the newspapers or on the mainstream media, on television? What would you, if you had your chance, what would you say to them?
To never give up. Families must never give up. Families have to support each other. That makes you strong. It's difficult for some people to see all of the, you know, the deaths on, you know, online. But they just must know that they are never alone. And we must keep fighting for justice.
Well, I just want to say how grateful we both are for your contribution, Marcia. I know even after 12 years how difficult it is and how obviously raw and painful it is.
It is raw and very, very, very painful. But the anger must always be turned into a positive anger to make real, effective change for this country and for many other families. There's no other way to do it. Turn your grief into positiveness, because we can win this collectively.
Thank you, Marcia.
Hearing Marcia speak with such eloquence about the death of her brother, Sean, really does reinforce what so many people, the Black Lives Matter movement, have been saying, which is that this isn't just an American problem, because one of the pushbacks has been, Dexter, it has no relevance to here, the UK. But of course, you yourself in your book, 10 Types of Human, talk about a young man, don't you? It's not just Marcia's brother. And in fact, there are many names that we can mention. And this young man, Gareth Meyer, who you mention in your book, I mean, he was restrained by prison officers. And a jury found that in fact, led to his death.
So Gareth Myatt was a young lad in a prison of dual heritage. And prison officers restrained him. And they were trying to get out of his property, out of his room. And didn't want to give them a little scrap of paper which had his mum's telephone number on it. And he was saying, as they were restraining him, "I can't breathe. I can't breathe." And they kept restraining him until he died. A child. And I just, sometimes it's easy to kind of despair about all of this, because hearing Sean Riggs' story about what happened in 2008 takes me back to one of the first of these cases that I did. And it wasn't in London, but it was in the Midlands. And it was about a person in another prison, a black man in his mid-20s now, called Alton Manning. And prison officers took Alton out of his cell, one of them on each arm. There were seven officers, one on each arm, two on each leg. And the seventh officer, they held him horizontally in this horizontal crucifix position. And the seventh officer held Alton's neck between his forearms, and Alton died. And so I was asked to go down to somewhere I've never been before, Kidderminster, Kiddo, to represent him, and there was no legal aid for the family. So if I hadn't done it, they would have been, the grieving family would have been unrepresented in the inquest into the death of their son and brother. And we had to try to find the truth about what happened, because Alton had injuries all over his body, bruising to his neck and his back and his torso, and injuries on his arms and his legs, and blood in his nose and his mouth and his ears. And no one knew anything. None of the officers knew anything. No one could explain how Alton died. And I had two weapons, really, to try to find the truth about the death of Alton Manning. And one of them was that sitting next to me in court was Alton's mum. And Alton's mum, all the way through this, was there. And every time a prison officer came into court to give evidence, I said to them simply this, you look at Mrs. Manning and you tell her why her son is dead. And not one of them could. Not one of them could. And that was an extraordinary, a powerful, powerful thing. But the other weapon I had, and it's interesting Marcia spoke about weapons, because the other weapon I had was the support of fantastic solicitors and an organisation which, I'm going to embarrass her, but for me are heroes of mine, frankly, called Inquest. And the director, well, joint director of Inquest, Deb Coles, is with us. Hey, Deb, how you doing?
Hi, Dex. Hi, Nihal.
Hi, Deb.
All right, so listen, we're going back when we were younger and much more, well, I'm going to say much more attractive. I'm not going to speak about me, but when we were doing that case, Deb, do you remember, you were, I think you were heavily pregnant, were you, at the time?
You're absolutely right. I was indeed heavily pregnant.
And how and was it with your son or your daughter?
So it was 1996
maybe, or 98, something like that.
Yeah.
Who would that be?
Yes. So that was with my daughter.
Okay.
Who's now 21. So there you go.
It just shows how this goes on and on. And so, Deb, in Alton's case, thanks to the support that I got from you and your organization, which I'd like to talk about in a minute, but also because of the truth. And Nihal, in this case, what was extraordinary was there was this sort of Alice in Wonderland flipping of reality, in that the jury, an all-white jury, thinking about the death of a black man in a place where we didn't see, at that time, I can't remember when we walked from the station, Deb, do you remember?
Yes.
Well, I didn't see any other minority ethnic people. In fact, Nihal, in the shop, on the way from the station, there were these black, I don't know whether you remember this, Deb, there were these black figurines you could buy in the shop window, carved wooden figurines of black, the black and white minstrels with big white lips and all of this. And I thought, there's no way we can get justice in this place.
Yeah.
No way. And how wrong I was. And this, I think this shows some of the hope that there is, because that jury reached a historic verdict. And by the end of it, they just didn't believe any of these prison officers. And who they did believe were the people who they would never believe in normal life, who were the prisoners. They believed the prisoners and didn't believe the prison officers, because these other people who were incarcerated were ingeniously using, it happened at night, using the windows on their cells, opening them, and they could use those to reflect the light and see how this person was killed. Deb, I mean, what do you think? I mean, just give me what you think about what we've been talking about today. Where are you coming from on that?
I mean, I'm always kind of emotionally connected to Marcia's story, because
I've worked with her for 11 years. And one of the things that's really struck me about this particular moment and the response to the murder of George Floyd has been, you know, acknowledging the pain and trauma of families who are reliving these events. Because, of course, as you've said, you know, it does resonate with the stories of the deaths of other black people who have died after being subject to the use of force across state institutions. So from, you know, from policing to prisons to, you know, immigration systems.
And psychiatric hospitals as well.
Absolutely, yes, indeed. And that's the, you know, that's the area of work that, of course, Inquest covers. But I think it's also about, I mean, you mentioned the Alton Manning jury, and I think it shows the humanity and the importance of juries presiding over these cases and the utter inhumanity and dehumanisation of people who come into contact with the state. And I think, you know, Marcia really articulated that dehumanisation when she talked about how her brother, who had mental ill health, you know, died as a direct result of the restraint used against him. And he was restrained for, you know, for 8 minutes. But also she talked about the struggle that families have to try and find out the truth about how their loved one died and the obstacles that are put in the way of finding out the truth and the delay and the denial and the defensiveness. And I don't know if you remember, Dexter, that around the time of Alton Manning, there were two other black men who died in prison, Kenneth Severin and Dennis Stevens. And the then Director General of the Prison Service went on Newsnight and suggested that black people were more susceptible to being suffocated or to dying in those circumstances than white people. And
was this excited delirium?
Yes, and just the physical susceptibility to death.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Nihal, we're not joking. This is exactly what was happening. This is the narrative, Nihal, that was happening, Nihal.
And this was the director
general. To contend with.
This is the director general of the prison service.
Prison service.
And I have to say, it kind of, you know, it resonated with me again when we've been talking about the deaths, the disproportionate number of deaths of people from black and minoritised communities dying from COVID. And then thinking back to the first pathologist report into George Floyd, which, like so many postmortems when people die following restraint, concentrated on underlying health conditions and trying to absolutely deflect away from state violence. And I think we're at a time when, you know, I think it's really important that there's a focus on race and state violence and accountability, because our work has really highlighted that there are a pattern of cases that are synonymous with violence, with racism, with injustice and with impunity. And it's an issue that really does need to be put on the political agenda as well as the media agenda. You know, I think it's important to recognise that whilst we've been talking about men and you know, the child, Gareth, 15 years old, restrained to death. I mean, what does that say about our society? But, you know, black women too are dying, and Inquest have dealt with a shocking number of deaths of black women who've died from violence and neglect, particularly in prisons. But of course, also in you know, the case of Sherry Gross, Dexter, that, you know, that a case that you worked on. And, you know, I think that what really frustrates and angers, you know, I get really sad, I have to say, having done this job for 30 years, I get really sad, but I get so angry about the fact that the same thing is happening and that I see families whose lives are torn apart, who then have to endure processes that I think are designed more about obfuscation and a lack of truth, a lack of honesty, and the fact that the state time and again says, well, we will learn the lessons, you know, those meaningless words, because what we don't see is demonstrable change and action. And I have to say, just over the last couple of weeks, to see the mass releasing of statements by corporations, but also by UK police forces, saying that they stand alongside people and the family of George Floyd and, you know, for justice and accountability, when those are the very police forces that do their best to evade any kind of responsibility or accountability for the deaths that happen in their care. And of course, you know, deaths are the extreme manifestation of a continuum of racist policing. You know, we've seen recently serious concern about the disproportionate use of tasers against black men. We know that black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched. We know that black people are disproportionately imprisoned. And to go back to the case of Gareth Myatt that you started with, we know that even today, children are being subject to pain-inflicting restraint. And the kind of restraint that if parents did that to children in their home, they would be prosecuted and brought to account. And that sense of the fact that state agents, you know, police officers, prison officers, immigration officers are above the law, that is what has undermined so much confidence and trust in our society, when you see time and again nobody being held to account. And what the message that sends out is that these black lives, these lives of men, women and children who have died, are simply not valued.
Well, I think looking at Sherry Gross, as some people will know, here was a mother in Brixton who was shot in the back by the police in front of her children in her home. And she remarkably survived a long time, more than any doctors ever predicted, just sheer tenacity. But when she died, and there was an inquest into her death about the police shooting, again, why I kind of jumped in, and was it because the legal aid position, Deb, as you know, as well as I do, is just so difficult and always a struggle. And she, the family of Miss Gross were denied legal aid until we threatened to judicially review their decision, and eventually they capitulated. But where someone is shot in the back by the police in front of their children, and then the state agency that deals with it says, by the way, the family are not going to be entitled to legal aid to investigate whether anything went wrong there. That's the kind of difficulties
Is that the bureaucracy of the system, or is that a pernicious need of the system to protect its own?
Well, I would say it's the latter. You know, I think it's important for people to understand that if you are an agent of the state, so a police officer or a chief constable, you know, your legal representation at inquests is routinely paid for out of the public purse. There is a serious and ongoing inequality of arms when you look at the situation for families whose loved one die, you know, in the care and custody of the state. Legal aid applications are distressing, they're protracted, and they are means tested. And so families have to answer questions about even whether they have any valuable jewellery, for example. And this is at a time when they are grieving, and all they want to know is, how is it that my loved relative died in your care? And yet, unlike you, we have to fight for funding, whereas the state automatically instructs teams of lawyers to go into inquests where their tactics are routinely to try and demonise or blame the person for their own death and to deny their responsibility for any of the system failings, violence or neglect.
Well, look, I think we've just scratched the surface of this, Nihal, really. I think we wanted to start talking about this. And there is, I've got a list of about 20 points I was going to make, Deb. Well, you know me. and we've taken up a lot of your time. And I hope you'll come back again because, you know, there's so much more we need to talk about, isn't there? Deb, just thank you. And I just want to also, on behalf of the lawyers who do the kind of work that you're connected to, in almost, I think in every single one of these cases, the results that the bereaved family have received, with the damning narrative verdicts from juries, I don't think any of that would have been possible without inquest. And so I just want to thank you that you and your colleagues, frankly, you're an inspiration to us. And I've, as I've always thought, it's one of the most incredible NGOs in the country, if not the world. So thank you, Deb.
Oh.
Yeah, Deb.
Well, thank you, Dexter. That means a lot. It's a team, and that's the important. And I think it's really important that the programme has looked at the human stories behind the statistics, because they are what I hope will result in change.
Mm. Yeah. Yes. Hope.
So, yeah. So thanks, Deb. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Deb.
Okay. Speak again, I hope.
Speak soon.
You will. All right. We will definitely. See you. It's easy.
Tell me.
To get very, very pessimistic in the game you're in, I have to say, Dexter, because I just kind of, as you read around it, the deeper you disappear into it, you know, I'm privileged.
I'm not pessimistic though.
Right. I guess you've seen wins, right? You've seen wins. Whereas me, I'm in the media. I'm in the media, and we report the losses. I mean, that's what we tend to focus too much on. You know, that's the problem with the game I'm in, is that we get...
Can I tell you a win? Can I tell you a win?
Please, I need to hear
one. Can I tell you a win? In Alton's case, going back to Alton Manning, here's a win. The win is that we went down there and it seemed an all-white place, an all-white jury, all-white prison officers, and everyone else in court was white. And there was Alton's mum and his sister, who were a black family from Birmingham. And there was me, a minority ethnic lawyer, who had no legal aid, had virtually no papers, knew nothing. There were loads of other lawyers paid for out of public funds by representing the other parties, the prison officers, the prison service, the nurses, I think the police as well. But here was what the win was. The win was that jury of 11 white people, they saw the truth and they were furious. They were furious about the death of a black man. And by the end of the case, it was an extraordinary moment which just fills me with hope. What happens is that in inquests, it's a very strange feudal jurisdiction where you have the questioning, rounds of questioning by the lawyers for the various interested persons, but then you have a round of questioning from the jury. And there came a point in the inquest when I would stand up to cross-examine prison officer number 19 or whatever it was, and they would come out with the same lies. And the jury actually said to me, "Do you mind if we go first, Mr. Diaz?" And they kind of took over, and they were so angry about what happened. And it was a deeply, deeply emotional thing. And I will never forget that moment when the jury came back in the town hall in Kidderminster. And the foreperson of the jury stood up and announced that the verdict of the jury, which was a historic verdict, that Alton Manning, this black lad from Birmingham, had been unlawfully killed by those prison officers. And all hell broke loose in court. It was just this white noise everywhere. And Alton's sister stood up in the aisle next to me and she pointed at those officers and she was shouting, "You killed my brother! You killed my brother!" And I remember I turned to Alton's mum, who was sitting next to me, and I said, I'm very sorry for your family, Mrs. Manning." And she said, she said to me, "Look, you are family, Mr. Dears. We are all family, but families bicker, and somehow we've got to sort this out." And, you know, I think what this moment gives us right now, with what's happened to in Minnesota and Black Lives Matter, is an opportunity to try to start sorting something out in a different way.
You okay?
Yeah, I'm good. It's just, you know, because, you know, what happened after that, just to round it off and to, I suppose, prove your point, mate, is that we had a unanimous, beyond reasonable doubt, unlawful killing verdict. Alton had been unlawfully killed. The prosecuting authorities didn't prosecute or didn't charge a single officer, not even for assault, let alone manslaughter, not even for assault now, after there was this unlawful killing verdict. So we went back to court. We took it was the director of public prosecutions. We took him to court to say that his verdict or his decision not to prosecute was legally perverse and irrational. And the highest judge in the land, the Lord Chief Justice, agreed with us and quashed the DPP's decision not to prosecute in that case. And so they had to go back and think about it again. And they took years and nothing happened. And in the meantime, Alton's mum was just brokenhearted and fell into deep depression and died. His brother, who every day when I went to Kidderminster Town Hall to go to the case, would be sitting on the steps outside and would say to me, "You train him up good today, Mr. Dears. You train him up good today." And he was an amazing source of support and inspiration. And he was broken by what had happened. And he did have some mental health problems, but they were exacerbated by the death of Alton and also the fact that no one seemed to care and do anything about it. And he died in a psychiatric hospital some years later. So, you know, there are good things, but there's a lot of work to do. And so that's why, you know, I just wanted us to start talking about this, because I do think that there is a deeper conversation that we've got to have right now.
Couldn't agree with you more, Dexter. Couldn't agree with you more. But I just feel there's an energy now behind this that I've not felt before.
Talking about these cases always leaves me a bit conflicted, because it's really about the pattern that emerges. And we've talked about one in particular, the tragic case of Sean Rigg. But, you know, if I think, you know, put together the cases that I've been connected with or I've actually been counselling over the years in various ways, it's a kind of alternative social history. Because there was Cynthia Jarrett, a mother who died of a heart attack in contentious circumstances when the police searched her home. That led to the Broadwater Farm riots. Cynthia was black. Roger Sylvester, who was aged 30, died of brain damage and a heart attack while six officers restrained him on the floor. Roger was black. Joy Gardner was a mature student and mother, and she fell into a coma and died of asphyxia when police officers from what they called the Alien Deportation Group gagged her with 13 feet of tape around her head. And Joy was black. Christopher Alder, 28-year-old man, was taken to a police station injured. And the officers stood about. There was CCTV of them standing about for 10 minutes watching him die on the floor beneath them. And Christopher was black. Zaid Mubarak was put into a cell with a known psychopathic racist who got up in the middle of the night and clubbed him to death and then drew a swastika on the wall with a rubber of his shoe. And Zaid was Asian. Gareth Myatt, 15-year-old child, who wanted to hold on to a piece of paper with his mother's telephone number on it. And he was restrained by three prison officers, and he was saying, like George Floyd, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe." And he died. And Gareth was BAME. Sean Rigg, we've spoken about. Olusheni Lewis was an IT graduate who died while being restrained by 11 officers. And Olusheni was black. Alton Manning, as we know, was killed unlawfully in a prison, and Alton was black. And then Cherry Gross was a mother who was shot in the back in front of her children in a home, and Cherry was black.
This is, I guess, something that very starkly answers the question, why are you doing Black Lives Matter here in the UK? This is an American issue.
Mm.
I think the list that you've just read out there certainly answers that question. Now, we're so grateful to the amazing Marcia Rigg for giving us an insight into how these tragedies actually impact real families.
And also to my colleague Deb Coles of the NGO Inquest. Please do look up Inquest online and see if you can support their truly vital work.
We hope you enjoyed that conversation. Although perhaps enjoyment is not the right word, we certainly hope that it was eye-opening for you. In the next episode, we're carrying on with the theme of understanding Black Lives Matter.
And also talking about, more widely, race, racism and racial justice.
Also, do not miss Dexter's book. It's called The 10 Types of Human, and the very reason why Dexter and I are now mates. We bonded over his book.
And you can find out a lot more about this podcast, and there will be information and links about everybody that we feature at the website 100typesofhuman.com.
And we want to hear from you. So if there's anyone you think that should feature on 100 Types of Human, also as well, feedback on what you like and what you don't like.
You can follow us on Twitter at 100 Types of Human. Also, I'm at Dexter DSQC, and Nihal is at The Real Nihal.
And I'm going to keep saying it, please do subscribe so you don't miss an episode. So until next time, it's a goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.